אז איך שנסתכל על זה ונסתכל כן פעמיים, היום זורם זורם כמו אתמול כמו שלשום.
This is Dr. Ali Evans welcoming you to Light on Health, a show where we shine the light on a full spectrum of topics that affect your health and that of our entire community. My guest today is Corinne Almquist, who is a certified nurse midwife at Columbia Memorial Hospital and a good friend of mine. So I'm excited to have a very good friend in here to talk with. Welcome to the show.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
Yes. So before we get started, tell all of our listeners how your trajectory led from Vermont in New England all the way to the furthest part you could go.
Sure. So I finished midwifery school in 2016 and did my training in both Connecticut and Vermont. And at the end of that time, I had a scholarship from the U.S. government where I had to do at least 2 years of service in an underserved community. There weren't actually any that qualified in Vermont, which was really surprising.
That is surprising.
I think because Vermont just doesn't have the population.
Right.
And I figured if I couldn't live in Vermont, I didn't want to be on the East Coast anymore.
Yes.
So I decided to come out west. And Astoria really drew me in for its size and just the community of people here. And it seemed like a really great fit at CMH.
And we're apparently the underserved.
Apparently.
We the underserved.
Yes. And so, yeah, I've been here for 2 years now and certainly have no inclinations to leave anytime soon. So it was,
we won't really let you anyway.
I think it was a really good move for me.
Yeah. And tell, for the listeners out there, tell people kind of what's in your scope and what you do as a nurse midwife here.
Sure. So I trained as both a certified nurse midwife and as a women's health nurse practitioner. So my training was actually sort of half obstetrics, half gynecology, probably a little more obstetrics heavy.
Mm-hmm.
But I'd say one of the really nice things in my practice in Astoria is that it truly is 50-50 and maybe even a little bit more GYN heavy.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a really nice mix of just well woman care and annual exams and pap smears and IUD insertions, as well as prenatal visits and attending births and helping women throughout their pregnancies.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it's a really great combined practice. We have two nurse midwives and then three full-time OBGYNs, and we all share patients and have a really great joint practice over at the hospital.
And that's something some of my patients have asked this question. If someone wants to see you, so let's say in the OB world, someone knows I want a midwife at my birth, they can't necessarily specify who's going to attend their birth. Is that right?
Correct. So okay. That's one of the limitations. And I think most practices now do it that way.
Mm-hmm.
Just because providers do have days when they're on call.
Yeah.
And when they're not on
and
call.
And you don't want to be on call all
yeah,
of your
as a
life.
Provider, it's really challenging being on call 24/7. I used
yeah.
to work as a doula before I did midwifery training, and I was on call 24/7.
Yeah.
And that it is really challenging to
yes.
have any sort of life outside of your work.
What about in gynecology? If someone wants to come in to establish care, do they get to choose provider or not with that either?
Absolutely.
Okay.
You can choose to see whoever you want in clinic, whether it's for prenatal visits or for GYN care.
Yes.
But when it comes to
whoever's
on call when
yes.
you're in labor,
yes.
it's pretty much who's on call.
Yes.
Although you can opt out of having the midwife if one of us is on call.
Oh.
Although we've only had a few people in the couple of years I've
uh-huh.
been here do that. But
yes.
that is an option.
Got it. So what I really want to talk about, I think, today, there's in this world of women's health, there's so many places we could go. But I feel like with current politics and what's happening, you know, both with the change in administration that happened 2 years ago and with this upcoming election and just sort of where we are politically in terms of our ability as women, but not just biological women, men who identify as women, people, you know, where are we sort of in this ability to advocate for ourselves and empower ourselves for the care we need,
mm-hmm.
both medically and politically? And I think it's just, you know, what I want to do is sort of help our listeners know, both from a very medical standpoint, like, what do we need to know? What do women need to know about what tests they need and what frequency they need to visit the doctor? And also, how do we advocate for ourselves? And not just the women, also men listening who have daughters and mothers and aunts and, you know, cousins and wives. And
right. Yeah. I think there's been a lot of confusion recently in what kind of screenings that we need as women or as men who have cervixes.
Yes.
But I think that, you know, the annual exam has sort of been this thing that we've been encouraged to do every year with our gynecologist and saying, okay, we have to go every year to get a pap smear. And that was the tradition for a really long time.
Yes.
And those guidelines have been starting to change for a variety of reasons. Pap smears are now only recommended every 3 years when you're in your 20s, starting at age 21, and then once you're 30 or older, every 5 years. And we can go into that, into why that is. Mm-hmm. So the question remains, okay, if we're only doing paps every 3 to 5 years, do we still need to come in for a yearly visit with our gynecologist?
Right.
There are a couple different answers to that. There's not sort of a clear yes or no. And there are a lot of different sort of societies and groups that recommend different things. And this is where it gets confusing. So, you know, in our practice as OBGYNs and nurse midwives, we kind of fall under the umbrella of ACOG or the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists.
Right.
So for their recommendations, they are still recommending a women's health annual exam every year.
Starting at age 21.
Starting at age 21, yep, you're still encouraged to go in before that to discuss birth control, to do STD screening, but you don't need an actual pelvic exam or physical exam.
Right.
ACOG is still technically recommending an annual pelvic exam, although they don't hide the fact that there might not be the internal exam might not actually be that useful. Mm-hmm. Like if you're asymptomatic, aren't having any problems, the chances that we're going to find something on doing an internal pelvic exam are pretty slim. Mm-hmm. It's possible, but pretty slim. But ACOG is at least still recommending an external exam yearly to make sure, you know, there are no lesions or anything that's visible on the skin, because not everybody's down there with a mirror every day looking at themselves.
That's right. And one thing to interject too, which I think is hard, and I often am kind of weighing this in my own counseling of women, is some of the recommendations are based on a cost-benefit analysis purely.
Absolutely.
Right? I mean, they're looking at how much disease does this prevent, and is this worth us paying for? And so as a woman, you do get to make that choice. You know, your most insurance is covering a preventative exam every year, whether or not you do a PAP. So just for women to know, even though there might be a recommendation, they can self-advocate, I'd like to come in for an exam on a yearly basis.
Right.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I think where we can get into trouble is sometimes insurance companies will only pay for one preventative visit a year.
Right.
So if you have both a primary care provider and a gynecologist,
yes,
they might not pay for both of those.
That's a good point.
And yep. So our point is, you know, absolutely people should be going in yearly to see somebody.
Yes.
And I don't feel 1,000% invested on who that is. Like
yes.
If you have a PCP, I think that is perfect.
Yeah.
You know, if a lot of gynecologists and women's health nurse practitioners do manage their patients as their PCPs, but I think a lot of us feel more comfortable in our specialties and managing, like, if you have GYN concerns or managing your birth control.
Yes.
And we're not necessarily going to be the ones who are starting you on blood pressure medication.
Correct.
Or managing your thyroid.
Right.
You would be a great candidate
yes,
to do
right.
that.
Right.
And certainly we feel comfortable doing those screenings, and I think that that's the recommendation of going in to see somebody for a preventive screening
yes.
every year so that you can, you know, get your blood pressure checked, get your cholesterol checked if you need to do that, you know, get a bone density screen once you're over 65 if you need to do
right.
that, be reminded about mammograms and colonoscopies and when those are recommended.
Yes.
But you don't necessarily have to be, you know, doing a pelvic exam every
right.
year.
Right.
So ACOG says, hey, we might as well be doing this.
Right.
the U.S. Preventative Services Task Force, which is like an independent panel of national experts, says, you know, there's not a whole lot of evidence of benefit
they have
or
a big
harm
question
to the
mark.
Pelvic exam. Yeah. The American College of Physicians and the American Academy of Family Physicians says, actually, we don't think this is a good screening tool to be doing pelvic exams, partly because it's an exam that causes women a lot of stress and a lot of anxiety sometimes.
Yeah.
And so from their perspective, it's not a sensitive enough screen to be doing every year for asymptomatic women.
Right.
And again, asymptomatic being the key term there. You know,
right.
if you're having any issues,
this does not apply to
come
you.
In for a public exam.
Exactly. And let's walk the listeners through sort of what's the difference between a pelvic exam and a PAP, and what is a PAP, and what happens when a result comes back that you have HPV, let's say, and kind of how it plays out, because I think that process can create tons of anxiety.
Right.
Understandably.
And it's really confusing for people because most people assume that if they have any sort of internal pelvic exam that a PAP is being done.
Right.
And that's not necessarily the case.
Right.
So, you know, a lot of people sometimes will go into the emergency department because they're having pain or they're having bleeding, and the provider there will perform a speculum exam and the patient will come in and say, oh, you know, I just had a pap smear in the ED.
Right.
ED physicians don't do pap smears.
Right.
I can almost guarantee that across the board.
Yes.
It's a preventative screening measure.
Yes.
So they may very well be doing a pelvic exam where they're inserting a speculum, looking at the vagina and cervix.
Yeah.
But what the pap is actually doing is it's collecting cells from the surface of your cervix and a little bit from the os of your cervix.
Mm-hmm. Which is the opening.
Opening of your cervix. And then we're collecting those cells and then we're sending them to a pathologist who actually looks at them under a microscope and says, hey, these cells are normal or they're abnormal.
Right.
And if they're abnormal, then we might need to follow up or test for the HPV virus, which is the virus that can actually cause cervical cancer.
Yes.
So I think there's a lot of confusion about, you know, how often should we be doing PAPs? What are PAPs? Are PAPs actually testing for endometrial cancer?
Right.
They're not.
Right.
In rare cases, they can pick it up. Like, because if you have cells from the inside of your uterus that
are all of a
sudden appearing on the outside, that can be an indication of endometrial cancer. But for the most part, with pap smears, we're just looking at the cells on your cervix.
Right.
And the recommendations now is to start at age 21, regardless of when you've become sexually active.
And even if you have not been sexually active.
And even if you've not been sexually active, to start with PAPs and PAPs only and do that once every 3 years.
Right.
And then what we do is if the PAP comes back abnormal, we co-test it for the virus called HPV, which is the virus that in 99% of cases causes cervical cancer. It's not going to cause cervical cancer 99% of the time. It's just that 99% of cases of cervical cancer are caused by the HPV virus.
That's right. And there's only a couple strains that are really connected. Of all the HPV virus, there's only a few strains that are really strongly correlated with cervical
cancer.
Correct.
So there are over 100 strains of HPV virus. We only know of 13 that are high risk and can cause cervical cancer. However, what we do know about cervical cancer is that it's very slow growing. So for a woman with a typical immune system, it takes 15 to 20 years to develop cervical cancer once you have that high risk HPV virus. And so that's why we've moved to doing PAPs less frequently, because it's so slow growing.
Such a slow process.
And most people clear it within a few months.
Right.
And 90% of people clear it within the first couple of years.
And I think that's a really important point that I always make, is having the virus does not equal getting cancer. You need the virus, but you also need the environment for which the virus to grow and the immune system not to clear it. You know, so the strength of your immune system in being able to clear it. And, you know, everyone has been exposed to HPV. It's a virus that is ubiquitous. It comes, it goes.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's actually why we're not specifically testing people in their 20s for that virus, unless the cervical cells are abnormal, because we just assume that everybody has it. It's this virus that almost everyone has been exposed to. And even, you know, technically you can get it if you haven't ever had penetrative intercourse. So, you know, if you, it can live under the fingernails.
Lovely.
It can be transmitted skin to skin. So that's why we recommend, even for women who've never had sex, for women who have, but with same-sex partners.
Right.
You know, we still are recommending PAPs every 3 years in your 20s.
And let's talk for a minute about same-sex women and women who are with women. In that population, same exact guidelines. You don't change
exact guidelines. We tend to see a lower risk of HPV for women who've always had female partners.
Yes.
But certainly it's still possible to acquire the virus.
Yes.
So that's why those guidelines
are the same. Yes.
Yeah.
And transgender, so men to or female to male. Mm-hmm. Transitions, same guidelines.
Same guidelines.
If you have a cervix.
Mm-hmm.
How about hysterectomy? So a woman's had her uterus removed. Let's say that she's had her uterus and her cervix removed.
Mm-hmm.
Then she's clear. She doesn't
need to have a PAP. Unless she's had some sort of abnormality before. That's called CIN3. Unless she's had like a severe abnormality before she's had a hysterectomy, then technically the recommendation is if you've had a hysterectomy and you've always had normal PAPs, you don't need to get any more PAPs. Mm-hmm. Some people are still doing PAPs of the vaginal cuff post-hysterectomy.
Yes.
And I actually have seen those come back abnormal in women who have never had abnormal PAPs before. And that's because the HPV virus, you know, can linger. And that can be a really challenging thing to explain to, you know, patients who've been in monogamous relationships for 40 years.
Yes.
They've always had normal PAPs. All of a sudden, they have one that comes back HPV positive.
That's right.
You know, it doesn't mean that anything funky happened
in their
relationship.
And that's a great point.
It can mean that, you know, they acquired it when they were 18
and
it's just
hung
been
out.
Lying dormant
that's
in their
right.
system, and all of a sudden something happens with their immune system or something happens in their life or they're more stressed or something's going on.
And you can kind of think of it like a cold sore, the way cold sores just kind of hang out and then pop back out and hang out and pop back out. Same kind of deal. HPV can kind of just hang out there.
Exactly.
Yeah.
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 So then the reason that we recommend changing the guidelines once you're 30 is because at that point, we both sample your cervical cells and we test for HPV no matter what. And the thinking is that if both of those are negative, your cervical cells are normal, you don't have HPV, you can then go 5 years before you have another screening, just because we know that cervical cancer grows so slowly that even if you were to go out and contract a high-risk strain of HPV the next day, we'd be able to catch it in time when you came back in 5 years.
And that does not mean you don't go in for a doctor's appointment or a preventative exam. It means you don't need a PAP.
Exactly.
Yes. So different.
Right.
Yes.
And you still may get a pelvic exam. And
yes.
that is usually discussion between you and provider as to, you know, whether that would be helpful or whether that's something that you need.
Yes. So the message is basically if you have a cervix, you need PAPs, but the guidelines change in terms of frequency depending on risk factors and your history of abnormal PAPs.
Correct. But in general, every 3 years, starting at age 21 until you're 30, and then every 5 years from 30 on. And the recommendation is that you can stop screening at age 65 if you've always had normal PAPs or have had normal PAPs for the last decade. So one good news about getting older, fewer pap smears.
Yes.
Or no pap smears.
Yes.
The one thing you have to do less of,
screening
wise.
Right. And before the show, we were talking, and I think it's an important thing to bring up to our listeners, in conversation about transgender, we were talking about a policy that is on the table.
Yeah, we were sort of talking about, you know, the recommendation for transgendered men who still need pap smears. And I brought up the point that, you know, we're really not going to have to worry about that anymore because, you know, according to the new policy, transgendered identity doesn't exist. So,
which I don't know if
you can't see me rolling my eyes, I'm rolling my eyes.
Her eyes are all the way on the back of her head. In fact, I can't see her eyeballs. Yeah, so something for people to be aware of, I think we're talking very medical things, but in this kind of political climate, so much happens that starts to rule over our reproductive rights and really our anatomy.
Absolutely.
You know, and so this idea of politically not being able to identify, not having this option to be gender X.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a huge issue, and I think it's one that our current governor has done a really good job in championing and making sure that Oregonians who are transgender can identify that way on their driver's licenses, and you know, in public in general, and can feel safe in doing that. And you know, I worry about who else might come along, or you know, what our current administration is doing to just completely eliminate transgender identity from our current discourse, which it's not based in science, and you know, anyone can tell you that what your chromosomes say is not necessarily what your sexual identity is.
Well, and we have this whole field of epigenetics that's blossomed, which is basically the scientific study of that which affects everything outside of the expression of genes, meaning like you can have genetics that say this, but epigenetically, how it expresses in the real world can be completely different.
Absolutely.
So, you know, minimizing anything to pure chromosomes is pretty archaic at this point.
Right. Right. And yeah, for those of you who haven't heard, but there's a new policy proposal that would basically eliminate transgender identity as an option.
And on the birth certificate.
On the birth certificate. Mm-hmm. Well, it would basically say that your chromosomal makeup at birth states your sex for the rest of your life, and this is immutable. It cannot be changed no matter what you identify as, and you would have to provide chromosomal evidence that you are now a different sex to be able to be recognized as a different sex or different gender.
Can you see me shaking my head?
Allie's eyes are now
all the way in the back of my head. So on that very happy note, let's take a minute just to talk also about what women need to know in terms of breast health, mammograms, and that sort of frequency. So the recommendations around that.
Right. So recommendations in terms of clinical breast exams, where you actually go in and have someone palpate for any lumps.
Yes.
Recommendations from everybody are pretty wishy-washy.
Yes.
ACOG says, hey, we should offer this to women between the ages of 25 and 39. Mm-hmm. And we should be starting mammograms, or we should at least be offering mammograms at age 40 and doing them every 1 to 2 years. American Cancer Society does not recommend clinical breast exams. They do still recommend mammograms. So I want to make sure that difference is clear. The mammogram is where you actually go in and have
a radiographed image.
Exactly. Yes. You know, where your breast is pressed between two plates. Everyone complains about how uncomfortable it is. Mm-hmm. They're getting better. We now have 3D mammogram machines that are actually a little bit more comfortable, and we're actually offering those
at Columbia Memorial now.
Hospital now. And they're great for a number of reasons. One, it's more comfortable. Important. Mm-hmm. Two, it greatly increases the sensitivity in finding something abnormal, and it reduces the number of callbacks, because something that may have looked funny on 2D imaging, we can now actually see all the way around on 3D imaging and say, you know, actually this looks benign.
It looks quite benign.
Or actually,
yeah,
you know, this doesn't. And so women are having to be called back a lot less, which is really helpful.
Yes, yes.
But yeah, so mammograms pretty much across the board. The USPSTF, again, the US Preventive Services Task Force, the American Cancer Society, ACOG, all recommend offering around age 40, but definitely recommend starting screening at age 50. And mm-hmm. then whether you do every year or every other year is sort of up to you, your family history, what your provider thinks. And then similarly, you know, starting at age 40 or 50 is also somewhat personal preference or what your provider thinks. I think generally us as midwives, obstetricians, gynecologists recommend starting at 40 because the risk is so low. People worry a lot about radiation from the mammogram, but it is such a minute amount of radiation. Like, it's less than getting on an airplane and flying across the country.
Right.
So the risk of that is so low compared to the benefits that you get from that. So why not?
Talk for a minute about younger women with dense breast tissue and kind of what you as a clinician recommend to them? Because a lot of times with really dense tissue, what ends up coming back in a mammogram is this tissue is really dense. We can't make any definitive, we can't figure it out really. We can't say definitively one way or the other.
Right.
And so you're sort of left with this maybe more anxious question mark, you know, uh-oh, something's sure. wrong with me. I have really dense breast tissue.
Sure. And oftentimes what we'll do is we'll offer a follow-up ultrasound, yeah. which is better at looking at tissue that is dense. The 3D mammogram also does a little bit better than the mm-hmm. 2D mammogram at getting through that dense breast tissue and really sort of parceling out the different sections of it. But, you know, that's why we also always recommend just knowing what your own breasts feel like. So mm-hmm. that's something that you can do really easily at home. You know, lots of women have lumpy, bumpy breasts, and just yeah. knowing what lumps are normal in yours.
Yes.
And always coming in and getting it checked out if you feel anything that you haven't felt before.
Right.
Usually the best time to check your breasts is right at the end of your period. That's mm-hmm. when you have the least fibrocystic changes mm-hmm. in your breasts. So it's usually when you have sort of the least lumps and bumps in there that can be alarming if you're not mm-hmm. used to checking your own breasts.
Yes. So any sort of, I don't know, words of wisdom or parting ideas or just anything you want the listeners who either identify as a woman or, you know, care about women in their lives that this affects, anything that you sort of feel like people should know or be aware of or self-advocate for, just any words of wisdom you can think of?
I think just being aware that we all have a lot of responsibility to advocate for ourselves and our peers. And, you know, I think clinically we have a lot of amazing providers in town who specialize in women's health. You know, never hesitate to start up a conversation with one of them mm-hmm. or go in to see them. And then, you know, I think politically, just advocating for women. And, you know, we have so many amazing female candidates running for office, amazing yeah. male candidates too in yeah. Astoria. But, you know, we're only 14 days from the election. So
that's right.
Go ahead and vote.
Vote, right? And anyone who wants to get in touch with you, the phone number for them to reach you at? Not your personal, but through work.
Sure. So the phone number for the Women's Center is 503-338-7595. And I'm sure we have a wonderful team of OBGYNs and nurse midwives. And, you know, we would all love to talk with you. I think that we have some really great GYN surgeons. So I think that's one. We're amazing. We're offering some really fantastic services for people in Astoria now, whereas they used to have to go to Portland for some major GYN surgeries. But
can you give us a couple examples to that?
You know, hysterectomies, for mm-hmm. example, yeah. you know, just repairs that people need. Hopefully we'll be offering some more urogyne surgeries as well. Mm-hmm. But things like that where people were driving to Portland to get these services, but
yes.
we can do it right here. And we have surgeons who are really good at what they do. And yeah, I have the highest respect for my colleagues, and I would send anyone that I'm seeing to them
yeah.
if they need anything.
Yeah. And so anyone can get in touch with you that way through the phone number and the whole Women's Center, mm-hmm. the Women's Pavilion there
yes.
at Columbia Memorial.
Absolutely.
And I forgot to pause to remind everyone who they're listening to speaking. So for all of you who have been listening to an anonymous voice, we're speaking with Corinne Almquist, who is a certified nurse midwife at Columbia Memorial. And you've been listening to Light on Health. Thank you so much. I feel like I want to keep talking. Maybe politics that we can't talk live on the radio. Very special thank you to Joanne Rideout for working all those dials and engineering our show for us. It is my hope that we've enlightened and empowered you to take one tiny step forward towards your own radiant health. And don't forget to vote.
היום זורם זורם כמו אתמול כמו שלשום.
Thanks for listening to Light on Health on Coast Community Radio, KMUN Astoria, 91.9 FM, KTCB Tillamook, 89.5 FM. We're streaming live on the web at coastradio.org. You can hear us on your mobile device using the free TuneIn app. And now this.